Welcome, pudding people, to another episode of Everybody Loves Pudding. I am your host, Ken Seymour. With me today, we have a legend in the television and film industry, a man that has been involved with a number of productions that I expect that you are intimately familiar with and probably hold near and dear to your heart. We have the amazing Michael Hirsch.
Well, great to meet you, Ken.
I am so ecstatic to have you on the show today. When I heard that you were releasing an autobiography by the title of Animation Nation, out in stores this July, going to announcer voice, it just piqued my interest. And I have to say, when I saw the list of different programs that you were involved with over the years, my jaw hit the floor. I like to think of myself as someone that already knows a little bit of pop culture, and I thought I knew some, but I clearly did not know anywhere near what was going on. And I have to ask, for somebody that's been in your position as in making these things as long as the word, the thing that struck me that I want to know about is, did it always feel like you were flying by the seat of your pants? Reading through the text, it's like, wow, it seems like you were always just barely getting to that next thing.
You know, you hit the nail on the head. It's a strange phenomenon because, you know, when you're just starting out, you think, well, if I just make it, right, then everything is going to be easy and I'll have total confidence and everybody will have confidence in me and the work will flow in. And that really wasn't how I built my career over multiple companies. And talking to other people, they all have the same situation. You know, you're always, particularly if you're stretching, right? If you're trying to do new creative things, you're going to where the technology is taking you as technology evolves, and you're breaking your mold and not doing everything exactly the same way, you really are flying by the seat of your pants. You know, you're doing your first fully animated show, then you're doing your first CGI show, then your first 2D digital show, and then the technology and the software changes, and maybe you're going from Maya to another software. So you're constantly being pushed in our era to do something that's refreshing, new, you know, the reach of audiences. How do you reach audiences? How do you work with YouTube, which never existed before, right, at a certain point? So I've had the benefit of building a career in these companies at a time when technology was changing rapidly, right? And we had to go from, you know, making shows just for TV to making shows for TV and home video, and then TV, home video, pay TV, cable, streaming.
Do you think that it just seems like it's an inherent early strength that might have helped you with, whether it's just perspective or approach? You were actually fairly well traveled pretty early on, and you know, my co-host occasionally pokes me a little bit and says, you love your Canadians, but you've been all over the world and managed to be exposed to not just different cultures, but different methods of doing business. How has that affected your approach to the production of television and movies?
Well, that really left me open, you know, to new ideas and new ways of doing things. And coming from a country like Canada, where there really, when I started my first animation company, Nelvana, there was no animation industry here in Canada at the time. You know, people may know of the NFB, but they produced a few shorts a year. That was hardly an industry. So we had to be partnering and looking for, you know, international partners, whether in the US or whether in Europe or in Asia. Or in Australia. And so we were very open to that. And Canada actually developed these treaties with countries that were prepared to enter into cultural treaties where you could co-produce, and there was an organized method of working between countries that would recognize the content as local.
I know in the book, you talk about one of the earlier associations in one of the productions One of the individuals that you were working with managed to gain talent from all over the world, and you called it kind of a Tower of Babel that made the actual interfacing between all of the talent more difficult. Do you think that's still an issue today, or is it a different environment and it's easier to get that kind of international support?
Yeah, I think it's easier to do today. There's a lot more, first of all, a lot more French people, a lot more Europeans, a lot more Asians have learned English. English has become the kind of international language. So even though you don't run into everybody speaking English, many more people speak English. And then, you know, US and English language culture has been the dominant culture for a long time. So people understand the references, the cultural references. So working around the world has become an easier task. You know, when I first started doing it, it was tougher. And the first country that we worked in partnership with was France to produce Babar. And that made sense because Babar was a French language property originally. The books were written by Jean de Brunhoff, and then his son Laurent de Brunhoff continued. And they started in French, and then Laurent started to write in English. And when I first was introduced to Babar, I was just a child going to the public library, and the librarian would read, you know, from a book, and often it was a Babar book. And so I fell in love with Babar at an early age. And that made it easier to work with our French counterparts because often their English wasn't that good, but they were getting better and better at English as we went. And I could speak French and understood it. And a lot of our staff could as well, because Canada is a French language and English language bilingual country.
And now the Nelvana, the company of which you speak, that the name has interesting origins that the readers will be able to learn about in the book. But the thing that struck me that you mentioned that I had just no clue about, I mean, I thought I knew a little bit about trademark law, but you said in the book that Nirvana had to secure your permission to name themselves that. Is it a proximity thing? That just blew me away.
Yeah, so the musical band Nirvana had applied for a trademark. And because we had trademarks that pre-existed them for Nelvana, it could be misinterpreted, misunderstood, and so we could object. And We initially objected because we didn't know Nirvana, et cetera. And it was just what our lawyers would do automatically. And then when they, you know, appealed to us to reconsider, we granted them the right to use it as long as they were limited to music, because we felt that, you know, was not our sort of major area, though we did a lot of things with music. You know, we felt comfortable with granting them that exclusion, but that's common in trademark law. So for example, to trademark Babar, which was very important to us because we were merchandising and licensing it, to trademark Babar, we had to overcome an objection from a cosmetic company called Dr. Babur, B-A-B-U-R. And, you know, again, it was the same issue.
Wow.
And we worked out a deal with them. And then we had a very famous turtle at Nelvana, Franklin the turtle. And in order to secure a trademark in sports, we had to make a deal with the Franklin Sports Company. So, you know, this happens all the time. And usually people exact a toll and charge you something for it. And with Nirvana, because we were artists and respected them as artists, we just, you know, did it as a courtesy.
Seems like there's often more red tape than anyone on this side of the product exchange is going to be anywhere near aware, but we all feel that pull, that passion in the creation of the projects that you do. Where do you think that passion came from for you? What was your inspiration to be someone that would be a force that would create animation in the first place?
So in my case, I really fell in love with cartoons going to the theaters because there were still theatrical shorts. So you would go see the Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck cartoons on the movie theater. You'd see, Walt Disney's cartoons opening shorts as well. And so it was really those theatrical shorts that were my first introduction to animation. But I would, these were, this was an era where I would go to the movies every Saturday and go sometimes to a double bill, sometimes to a triple bill, because it was an easy way for your parents to get rid of you for 4 hours, 6 hours. And, and that's also how I saw the first, like the Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon serials. And all of that made me fall in love with, animation, movies. And eventually, when television came into the home, which was not that far off, I fell in love with television programs. And, I was just consumed by this form of entertainment. And eventually, when I was in high school, what really put it together for me was a friend suggested that we cut classes, and this was my first time cutting classes, to go see a program of experimental underground cinema, American cinema. And I was in New York at the time. And so we did that. And, I fell in love with the underground cinema of America and started to make films in high school. And, so the passion for making films, or the passion for watching films and being entertained by them, turned into the passion of making my own productions. And I kept doing that through college, and eventually it became a professional pursuit.
Now, this may be before your time. Did you ever get a chance to see any of the serialized content they created, like in the late 30s, that were based in the, I think it was like 37 that they did the Batman serials or the Shazam? Or were you able to experience that firsthand in a theater?
Yeah, because I would walk 10 minutes from my house. I was living in kind of central Toronto at the time. And I could walk 10 minutes, and there was a theater that ran double bills, and that was 25 cents. Or if I went another block, I could go to a theater for 15 cents that ran triple bills, but they also ran the old 30s and 40s serials. And so I saw them not first run, but like they were, you could see the scratches on the film as they were being projected, because, it was old films being, played over and over and over again.
But being able to see that and the original way that it was intended to be seen, there's got to be just kind of a sentimental spot for anybody that had a chance to be able to experience that.
Yeah, and what was fantastic about seeing Star Wars for the first time was that that was the first movie that triggered that kind of nostalgic feel for those old serials, because that was precisely what George was paying tribute to and had been inspired, by himself.
So that actually brings up a question that's going to fast forward us way forward, but I can't not ask it, because the industry has changed just so much in the way that media is consumed. And you were talking a little bit about having to kind of keep up with the changes in that a few minutes ago, but the movie theater is not what it used to be. Do you think, just in your opinion, from the way that you've seen the industry change, do you think that the movie theater is going to be able to survive in the way that it is now? Or do you think it's going to have to adapt in some way to come out of this successful in a different way?
Well, I think given the kind of quality of home cinemas people have, the need for cinemas for movies that aren't big special effects type movies is really not that apparent anymore, right? So unless you've got the big blockbuster, you're happy seeing it at home. So when you really need the full weight of like the giant IMAX screen or a giant screen of some sort and the greatest sound in the world, stepping into a cinema, there's nothing like it. But to go see a small art film, an independent film, to see a film that's a $10 or $20 million movie in the movie theater, I'm not sure is as, is as necessary. So my expectation is, while we have all these multiplexes, we went from having small cinemas of just, that would be one big theater, to building out these multiplexes. Now I think we'll probably see the next phase of building will be the reduction of the multiplexes and sort of the reinstallment of what we saw before of big theaters that that are well suited for the blockbuster.
That definitely makes sense to me. Although I feel like we're going to miss something a little bit in that, even if you're not watching a blockbuster, having that feeling of sharing the experience with somebody at the same time, you miss a little bit of that.
Well, you absolutely miss that. That shared experience is a big thing, and particularly for comedy, right? Because it's part of what makes a comedy so funny is you're in a room with lots of, with somebody starts laughing and other people start to laugh along with them. And, you kind of understand that something is funny in part because of the laugh. And that's why early TV shows had those laugh tracks, right? To tell you that something was funny, because you don't always catch it fast enough, right? But, as we look at it, our whole society is kind of moving away from, sort of being present in a shared way because of how people are interacting through their phones, right? Our form of communication through texting and social networks, has reduced the amount of interaction of people. So we're really changing as a species, and it's a very dramatic change. And at my age, it's kind of hard to understand, though we watch it and we see it happening. It's not one that I can fully appreciate.
I know I don't completely get it myself. I still try to keep up on the social media, and they explain, so this is the big new thing, and I go, okay, great. What does it do? Just this. Okay, great. I'll understand it once it's no longer popular. I'm sure that's how it's going to go. So these projects they do, these gargantuan projects that take so much effort and time to put together. There are so many facets to make them come to life, to come to fruition. One thing that you mentioned in your book that was an important aspect of it that you said that you came to enjoy quite a bit was the business lunch, was it? And I just, there's a lot of things that I can put my head in to imagine. I can be on the set, I can see through the eyes of the director, the producer. But from the business standpoint, what is a meeting like when you're taking a client to lunch, trying to get them to come on board with a project? What is the environment? What is the feeling on something like that?
So I think there's the key to it is really for an author to give you their valued work. It helps to have, this social time together where you can get on the same page and feel comfortable with each other. For a studio or a network to decide to develop a project with you or greenlight a project, it's important to have that social connectivity because this is a team sport. And if people don't feel comfortable with the people they're working with, it's not going to go well. So you have to establish that rapport and that degree of comfort. And a meal has historically been the way we do that as a society going back thousands of years, right? Breaking bread. And really just when you do that, you're often, more relaxed, you're comfortable, you're trading stories, you're learning about the other person and developing that sense of comfort. So I think really that's the essence of it. It's really old, but which, by the way, with what we were just saying about social engagement and how people aren't together the same way anymore, and particularly during the pandemic where everything was done by Zoom, the world is changing. So my experience of that business lunch as a way to do this is not as open a path as it used to be.
That it seems like that there's nothing to, if there's not something to replace that, that's really kind of a loss. That trust that you're talking about is where are you going to get that from if you can't develop it in a personal scenario?
Yeah. So I first started to see that breakdown when working with Netflix in particular. So they were like the first of the big social streamers. Or streamers, and they had a rule where, in the early days anyway, you couldn't take their people to lunch or dinner. You had to meet at their studio and have, a meal in their cafeteria. And that made it a much different kind of event. And the people they employed at that time were more making decisions on data rather than how they felt about somebody. So, in a sense, the human touch has come out of the process. Now, this can all evolve again because a lot of these people are now have been replaced in the social stream or in the streamers networking with people from the movie industry. But they too may have been impacted by this. So, I think we're just in a stage of constant evolution, which goes back to what we were saying before, that, we're in this ever-changing world and you have to fly by the seat of your pants and be prepared for the new way of doing things.
Now, I have to say that flying by the seat of your pants can cause some very interesting things to occur. I don't know if the word intrigued is quite right, but I couldn't stop laughing for about 10 minutes. It felt like an episode of Seinfeld when you were describing the day of your wedding. It's like that's got to be in a sitcom at some point. And have you been forgiven at this point for the way that that day turned out?
Well, so for the benefit of those listening, my wife and I kind of did everything backwards. We basically lived together first, then we planned a wedding day, but I forgot to, and we decided to do it at City Hall, but I forgot to book City Hall. And so people came from out of town, my family and her family came from out of town. And so we had a wedding party. But before that, frankly, after we announced that we were going to get married, my father sent us a wedding present, but he sent it saying, use this for your honeymoon. So we immediately went on our honeymoon. And then, having forgotten to book the wedding, we had the wedding party before we got married. Then, the day that we were supposed to get married, I went to lunch with my partners, and then I went like this. Oh no, I'm supposed to be at City Hall getting married. So we all jumped in a cab, had the waiter keep the food, and we got married in 10 minutes. And then I jumped back in the car with my business partners and left my wife and her friend on the steps, because by that time it was all kind of, what's the word for it? So we had done it. We lived together, we had the honeymoon, we had the wedding party, so the actual ceremony was perfunctory, but I've been living that down for ever since, which is like a long time now.
I bet. And if dear listeners, you get the chance, he has so many stories like this in the book. I'm not going to ask about this because it would be too much to give away. But the fantastic story you have about Mr. T in there. I just it is wonderful. So if you read the book for nothing else, read the book for that. But one of the other things that really kind of just amazed me is that over the course of your career, you've had the ability to interact with just such legendary people and be able to create stuff with them and for them. And I just kind of wondered when you meet these people like a Lucas or Haig or Tim Burton, inevitably you're going to pick up, some little nugget of wisdom. Do you have a favorite nugget of wisdom that you've learned from one of the people or multiple of the people that you've worked with over your career thus far?
And there's been quite a few. I've been, as you say, I've been very lucky. I've had some good mentors, so George Lucas did some mentoring with me. Jamie Kellner, who was a terrific executive who started the Fox Network NWB and recently passed away, was a good friend and got a lot of nuggets from him. And, my feeling is that what I've learned that really stuck with me was how important putting together the right teams of people are, how important working with the right people is, how much you have to kind of enjoy working with people to succeed. And in terms of George Lucas, he passed on so much more. And he is a very thoughtful person and was very, very perceptive about where the business was going to go and was an early investor in technology. And so, though we didn't Like I met John Lasseter and Ed Catmull when they were starting Pixar at Lucasfilm. But it was clear to me that it was too early, right? He had built Edidroid, the first interactive kind of editing machine using laser discs, right? That seemed too early. So he was always ahead of schedule. But we kept our eye on all of those developments so that we could jump in when we thought it was, more suitable for people who didn't have his kind of wealth and money behind him, right? An appreciation for, not being afraid of technological advancements, an appreciation for embracing them, but doing it as it suited us rather than just jumping in was a key thing.
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes I feel like I wish I could be a fly on the wall in some of these creative sessions, these meetings that occur that lead to new things. You talk about meeting and working with Debbie Harry and just some of the amazing musicians that were involved on that rock and roll project, which I still kind of hold near and dear to my heart. I always like that, and it just seems what surprised me is when you said that they all kind of recorded from different locations, and it always felt like it was always so much more cohesive. How do you think that project gained that cohesive feeling when so many pieces of it were being juggled from so many different studios?
Well, the studio portion is not a problem because musicians, even back in that era of the 80s when we made the movie, were used to recording part because they would be on a tour. So they'd go into a studio in, say, Cleveland, lay down a track. Then they would take it to their next place where they'd like to work on their tour, maybe New York, and they would do more on that track. And they would keep working it and bringing it around the world with them, right? So that was something they were used to. And we also had done that with our international co-production. So we kind of understood that you didn't have to have just one studio, right? That you could work in multiple studios in multiple jurisdictions. And then we had my partners were very strong on, determining with me what each song would be and what type of message we were delivering. And we were clear about delivering that and clear about providing the background of the story. Because what was unique about rock and roll was it's a rock opera, but there isn't one composer. Debbie Harry and Chris Stein, write the music and perform it for the female heroine, Angel. Lou Reed does that for the villain, Mock. Iggy Pop does it for the demon that, Mock wants to bring up from the netherworld. Cheap Trick does the music for the punk hero, and Earth, Wind & Fire do the dance hall music. So everybody's been cast in a sense stereotypically to something that, felt comfortable for them. And then they really worked well together, and particularly Debbie Harry and Chris Stein worked really well with Lou Reed and Iggy Pop. Lou Reed and Iggy Pop worked really well. They came from that same milieu of music, right, where they all had a punk background and were able to put that together with what they were doing in our movie. Then we had a composer who did the score, who worked with them when they had finished tracks to sort of orchestrate that and build that into the show, the movie's score.
That's if it still just it pains me. There's so many great films and shows that do not get an initial reaction that really reflect the level of quality that was put into them. And I always felt that that was a really good example of something like that. That was just so, especially for its time, so amazing in how it put things together. It's sad to see that it didn't do better than it did at the time.
No, it disappointed us because we had not only put our heart and soul into the movie, but We also ended up investing some of our own money. So we actually then had to work our way out of debt or go bankrupt. So that became the first real sort of, precipice the studio faced, the major risk. And we went from never having made a half hour, more than a half hour in a year, to doing 100 hours of television the next year. And so we produced the 20-Minute Workout, which was an exercise show that was quite successful. But we did Inspector Gadget, co-producing that with Deke, and a few other shows.
I tell you what, you're going to take me back to my childhood with that Inspector Gadget thing. And it's that show I loved as a kid and is responsible for the only, well, not the only, but one of the only impressions that I still do with, I'll get you, Gadget. You know, a little bit of Dr. Claw, and it's like stayed with me forever, and it's a joy. And that's the thing that also gets me. I had, all I ever saw when I saw that when it was on TV was DIC. I never saw Nelvana anywhere in the credits. They always had that just right up front, and that just kind of amazed me that you were able to be part of such a fun show.
Yeah, so we did a large part of the work on it, but what it was they had developed the show and had it sold in the U.S. and I was meeting with them on another subject, and they had just lost some of their funding. So Andy Hayward, who was the American head of Deke at the time, said to me, "Look, we can't do this other project we're talking about because we don't agree on it. But if you can figure out how to get this sold and get us 40,000 US from Canada, we'll make it together." And in order to qualify for getting this thing Canadian content, which is something you do in Canada, where there's these content regulations, if you can do that, then we'll co-produce it. In order to co-produce it and get the status, we ended up having to do all the storyboards and the key drawings, the layouts, and the post-production. So we did a lot of the work on the show.
Well,
it was their show.
Yeah, but you could see the quality in that. And I think that's why it persisted for so long. There are generations of kids that grew up watching that in syndication and after, and just it's just a joy to behold. Now, in the book, you make mention of seeing how companies would approach merchandising the shows as they were making them, talking about the Care Bears and the kids taking the Care Bears to the film. And I had a question kind of about that, because a lot of times the relationship of merchandising with the creation of the content is a kind of a weird one. Did you ever feel that the pressure to make profit off of the ancillary extra stuff that goes with the show would affect the quality or the storytelling of the show itself?
So we didn't let that get to us. We were very focused on making shows that we thought were better than the commercialization aspect. So we didn't treat Care Bears like they were just a toy commercial. We treated the characters like they were genuine and built up those characters and their characteristics. And the storytelling that we put in was the same as if we were doing something that was an A-level show. So we didn't treat a toy show like a C-level show, like just a job. And so that was one of the hallmarks of Nelvana at the time, was we really were focused on quality. And quality not just was the quality of animation, but the quality of, characters that you develop and the quality of the voices and the music, et cetera. And, it was one of the benefits that we got ultimately from working with Lucasfilm and working with Tim Burton and Spielberg, was that we basically were able to plus our game by what we learned from them. And not only them, but, the people who were their sound effects people, the music people, like their teams of people who were available to us to, learn from. And so we really focused on being a top quality studio. And at the time, animation had really, in the 70s, fallen into kind of a very weak art form, and particularly for US television, right? It had become very limited.
Yeah.
we started to put, double and triple the animation that was in a typical show. So we were doing shows that were 20,000 cells for a half hour, whereas at the time, Hanna-Barbera and their competitors were often doing 8 or 10,000 at best.
You could definitely see the quality differential between the two, the smoothness of the transition. That was always what appealed to me. It's like, oh, that, and for lack of a better term, you could see the effort, see the love that was being put into it. One of the other things that you talked about that kind of went hand in hand with the merchandising question in my mind, you had a couple of instances where you talked about having to pre-sell the projects that you were doing. Now, for those of us on this side of the business that have no idea what the difference between pre-selling and not pre-selling is, what does that mean, and what kind of pressure does that put on you to try and, make it work and get it going?
Well, it's interesting. So one of the difficulties of having an animation studio is when you're in live action production, you crew up and crew down with each show. In animation, it's hard to get that talented group together. So you really, it's hard to go just from project to project in animation. So you typically want to always keep the studio full and have the next project lined up. And so you're really building a company that has stability. And that helps the animators because they know where their next job is, and they're highly nomadic. They can leave and go work in Ireland or France or Japan or China or wherever, or another city, in our case, Vancouver or New York or LA. But so you're working to do that. And when you have to pre-sell, you have to pre-sell enough shows because we weren't owned by a network. We didn't have the fund. We couldn't just decide to put on a show and put it on the network. We had to go and convince somebody. So one of the big differences between, say, a young animator today and a young animator when I was starting off and building my companies is that we had to do these pre-sales. Today, somebody who's just starting off in their career can make something simple by themselves and make it on YouTube. They don't have a curator, they don't have a gatekeeper who's saying, "Yeah, I like that. Okay, I'll fund that." You're funding it yourself, but you're doing it with your you're investing your own time and energy in doing it. And so that's the real opportunity today for talent, is they can build something, they can build a character or brand. And as they succeed, they can actually earn money on YouTube and put some of that money into building that team that works on your show and improve the quality over time and eventually sell a Netflix or an Amazon or a Warner's or whoever on, taking the show to the next level. But unless somebody's pre-funding it, you really can't produce that premium television version.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it always seems like I've talked to a number of artists that always talk about kind of the paycheck to paycheck lifestyle is a little different for when you're creating art like that, and the feeling that goes along with it. But a lot of people don't think from the financing side and getting that all together. Now you've created this awesome company, and it's gone well. You've left Nelvana to pick up the pieces of another company that had problems, and that also just in my mind brought up a question. It was it the challenge when you create, was it Sidar? Was that the name of
Sinar.
Sidar?
Sinar.
Sinar. That had kind of a reputation, as it were, in the industry. What kind of drew you to want to make that something new, to create something bigger and better out of that?
Yeah, so we had sold Nelvana because we had reached a point where we felt we should be merged in with, Canada's largest children's channel company, which was Corus at the time. And then, as an entrepreneur, it's hard to stay more than a transitional period. So I stayed 2 years. And then when I left, our nearest competitor had blown themselves up, and that was Cinar. And they had the C the co-CEOs were engaged in some fraud where $134 million was raised from the public, and then it disappeared. And so they were fired, and the company was on the ropes. And I saw it as an opportunity to rebuild something. And I had, in a sense, retired young. At that point, I was only in my like 52 or something when I retired. And so I thought, well, this is too young to retire. Oh, I can go buy this company. So I worked with Topher Taylor, who had been a partner in Nelvana, and John Vanderbilt, who'd been a senior financial guy at Nelvana. And we engaged a private equity firm, Birch Hill Private Equity Partners, and we entered into the competition to acquire this company, and we're successful. But it was the personal challenge of, yes, fixing this thing, rebuilding it, and taking it to the next level. And we were able to do that. And we did it in part because the partners that I started with were interested in building a company. And at Nelvana, I had great partners, Patrick Loubert and Clive Smith. But to some degree, we had been together by the time the partnership ended, we had been together 30 years. And so people had become, they had different ideas, and we were not all on the same page by the end. And so the sale of the company was a way to end that partnership profitably for everybody. And then, and in their cases, they haven't, continued in the business, but sort of retired. And I felt the need to sort of do the next stage. And it was clear the world was going to streaming, so I wanted to build a library that would, make us successful in streaming. And we did at Cookie Jar, which is we renamed Cynar Cookie Jar. I like to joke that I took the sin out of Cynar, which means the company would have been called R. But then we added Cookie Jar, and we ran into problems with our private equity partners because they said you can't call it Cookie Jar. The previous owners of Cynar were caught with their hands in the cookie jar. We said, well, that's the point, But we used to have a lot of fun going to TV conferences where we would be either selling, licenses for merchandise, or selling our TV shows to buyers around the world. And we would bake fresh cookies in little cookie ovens. And so the odor, the fragrance of chocolate chip cookies and oatmeal cookies would waft through the convention center, and people would sort of drift into our booth and buy shows.
It's like selling a house. That's a good trick to have.
It was fantastic. Yeah, it really, and then for the Christmas holiday season, we were able to commission cookie jars of our characters, fill them full of cookies, and send them to people. And it was, there was kind of a real brand there at Cookie Jar.
The all these different productions, multiple companies, three different companies. You've had a chance to be involved with just some amazing stuff. Have there been any projects that you have wished that you could have produced? The one that got away or one that was never really a thing. If you had your choice, what would you love to still somehow get to make it happen?
So there were several of those projects that got away. One was we wanted to make the X-Men, the movie, as a live action special effects picture. And I had secured the rights from Marvel Comics, and we developed a script working with Roy Thomas and Chris Claremont, two great Marvel writers. And it was a great script, but we were working with Orion Pictures, and they didn't see the potential, and so they passed, and we lost our rights, and eventually a great X-Men movie was made. But I, regret that we lost that. We went after Curious George, and it was one of my childhood favorites, and I was sorry we didn't get it. The funny experience there was that Hans Rey's widow, who controlled the rights, I think Margaret Rey, kept saying to me, "George is real." So we kept coming back with drawings. We were wooing her by doing work, development work to show her what we would do. She said, "These are great drawings." We were making them more realistic, but she said, "But George is real." I didn't understand it. a few months after we lost that sort of battle to get the rights, she gave the rights to a young person just out of film school who had walked in and said, George is real. And
Oh.
he was planning to do a live action movie with a real monkey. And that's really what she was trying to say. Of course, it didn't happen that way. He got the rights, he passed them on to Hanna-Barbera. Eventually, they gave it to Imagine, and it got made as an animated movie anyway, right?
Yeah.
But that was a sad one to lose. We also, at one point, we had the rights to Rocky Horror Picture Show, and I wanted to do an animated series based upon that. I thought it would be a lot of fun. And we were trying to do it with MTV or HBO at the time, but we couldn't get arrested with it. It probably would have been makeable 10, 20 years later. We were just too early. And then finally, there was a moment where we had the rights to Batman, and we had developed a good series, but none of the it was prior to the Tim Burton Batman movie being a big hit, and people were dubious about how well a Batman movie would do. Nobody quite believed in it. So all the Saturday morning buyers passed on it, and we had to give those rights back. But
Beetlejuice.
we were able to trade it off and get Beetlejuice from Warners.
Another of my childhood favorites. that's kind of amazing how life kind of circles around and does those sorts of things. So this show, we tend to focus a lot of times on the intersection of comic books and other forms of media, whether it's television or movies or whatever, and you have had your hands in the cookie jar, as it were, of these kinds of things for a very long time. Are you a fan of comic books yourself?
I am a comic book fan. So it started for me when I was a kid. I liked reading comic books. For a very short period, my father, who was mainly in manufacturing, owned a variety store for a short period, and I would be there opening the bundles of comics and reading them before anybody else got their hands on them. And I fell in love with comics and continued being interested in comics through college. Moved from DC to, DC Comics to Marvel, and became a big Marvel fan. And over time, we produced the Tintin cartoon, which is based upon, graphic novels that are fabulous by Hergé that really are inspirational from an artistic point of view. And we did the series, the animated series based upon Wildcats by Jim Lee. And Savage Dragon and Sam and Max, they're just three of the comics that we did. We did a series based upon Committed, which was a comic strip. I was a big fan of comic strips as well, because I, as a kid, I'd read them in the newspapers, and they were, that was my version of the paper, was to read the funnies, the Sunday funnies.
Well,
So lots of great projects. And then the way we got the name for Nelvana was I had come across, so this is at the beginning of my career, I had come across the person who owned the comic books that were published in Canada during World War II. In Canada during World War II, they had an embargo on American comic books coming in because Canada entered the war before the US. And so there was this embargo on non-essential goods. Canadians started to make their own comics. And Nelvana of the Northern Lights was the heroine who gave us the name Nelvana, because prior to that, we had a small partnership called Laugh Arts. And people were afraid to hire us because they said, well, people pronounce your name LaFarts. And so why don't you choose a neutral name? And so we liked Nelvana, and it was inspirational for us, and it was evocative of our first big project, which was doing a book on the great Canadian comics and doing a TV documentary and a traveling art show.
Well, comic books and comic strips have always had a following, and people tend to connect with them. I mean, they were converted into film all the way back in the late 1800s. Some of the first silent films were based on comic strips. What do you think about this particular medium speaks to people?
The medium being comics.
Comics.
Yeah, I think it's a form of communication that's relatively easy for everybody to get, even if you can't understand the words, even if you're illiterate, you understand the meaning because the characters are drawn into with intention, right? And so it's very accessible, it's universally accessible, and it's quick. You can read it quickly. And so it doesn't require the kind of time that reading a novel, you can read Dostoevsky or you can read a comic book, right? You read the comic book in 10 minutes, Dostoevsky might take you months. So I think it's that. And then it goes back to the caves and the people who did cave drawings, right? So it's really this, in a sense, it's a primordial form of communication that's simple, communicates easily and well, and it's dramatic and exciting, and it engages you.
Yeah, this always engaged me, that's for sure. And the more clever the author, they still might sneak some Dostoevsky into it and you won't even realize it. So, what is next for you, Mr. Hirsch? What's on the horizon? What is exciting you? What is bringing you the joy to interact with the industry right now?
So it's really the opportunity to introduce my story to people through the book Animation Nation. I'll be at the San Diego Comic-Con speaking to my good friend Marc Evanier on the 25th of July at 10 a.m. And going to be at Fan Expo in Toronto and looking to go to New York for their Comic-Con. So in a sense, it's going out there and speaking to young people. And part of what excites me is really sharing the vision of where I think things are going. So we're in a very interesting time in the entertainment industry where the established legacy business has fallen apart. It's been destroyed by the new business, which is streaming. But unfortunately, streaming has destroyed the legacy business, which means there is no home video, there is no pay TV that's meaningful. There aren't going to be the cable channels. There's just going to be streaming, and that's where we're moving to. But as we were saying earlier, young people who want to get in the business have a path through YouTube and doing things for TikTok and Instagram and other platforms. So there's all sorts of other avenues into the business. And while I'm not going to be the one doing that, I have a vision for that. And I can be helpful to that next generation in sharing that vision.
Excellent. And if we wanted to keep up with the newest and coolest stuff that you're going to release, say, I don't know, a sequel novel, a how-to, whatever it is that you're going to be doing, what is the best social media that we can find your information on?
Well, you can go to my Instagram account, Michael Hirsch Animation. And I think that's the handle for my Facebook account as well. So
Excellent.
those are the two social platforms that I'm focused on currently. And I'm new to those platforms in the sense that I've spent the years, being behind the scenes, and now I'm sort of coming out of my turtle shell and addressing, the audience.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for granting us some of your time to talk about this really, really interesting book. Like I said, if you get the chance, you should definitely pick this book up and give it a read. It is a page turner. So if you are one of those people that don't like to read books, don't worry. It's going to keep you interested, and it's got some great examples of some of the programs and some of the things that were worked on. And it comes out the 23rd, correct?
That's correct, in the US.
In the US. So definitely check it out, get a copy of it, and I don't think that you will be upset about the purchase. I think you're going to read it multiple times. I know I actually have already. It's a lot of fun.
Well, thank you so much for a great interview. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you.